الغرائب فارفضوها.
Imam Ali said, when optional issues, the nawafil, stand in the way of the wajib, the fara'id, then abandon the nawafil. Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. One of the beautiful lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, is the concept of justice, and that too, justice for all. Now, we live in a day and age, as you all know, where justice seems to become justice for a few and injustice for a great many. And that justice for a few is also injustice in reality. So let me explain a little bit. The justice for the few means that the court systems and the laws, they apply to very few people in their true sense. And these laws can be broken, which is injustice in this justice. And for the vast majority of people, the laws are there, you know, and this injustice happens because no matter what they do, even if it's a mistake, they end up getting in trouble. Even if it was involuntary, they end up getting in trouble. But if somebody has power, if somebody has position, they can get away with murder. But if somebody is poor, disenfranchised, or even the common people, they can't even get away with crossing the road and jaywalking. Now, one of the things which we find with Imam Ali alayhi salam, and we find in the historical texts and the books of tradition, is that no common man was made disappointed by Imam Ali's justice. Meaning that person would not think that because I am a commoner, because I have no power, I will be deprived of justice. In today's day and age, when the common man, the average man, the average Joe, if you will, because they have no power, they don't have authority, they don't have wealth, they don't have position, they don't have status, they are not given the justice which should be given to them. They are, a matter of fact, deprived of justice. But when we go ahead and we look a little bit further, we find that those people who have wealth and status and position, they get away with everything. Nobody even bothers to say that these people are breaking the law. Oh, the law doesn't apply to these guys. They're too rich and famous for the law to apply to them. But this poor person, this common person, this person who is a middle class or lower class or is working hard in his life, you better not break any laws. Not a single one, or we will fine you and throw you in jail. Imam Ali alayhi salam's justice was so perfect that whether you were a common person, middle class or low class, or if you were incredibly wealthy, upper class, justice was always justice. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالمون يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
I just would like to share with you one sentiment or the feeling of a lady who was among the followers of Ahlul Bayt. And this is a lady who is known as Sauda bint Ammara bin al-Ashtar al-Hamdaniya. And she was from the family which believed in Amir al-Mu'mineen, from the Hamdaniya Yemeni family and the tribe. And she was a poetess in her own right. She was talented in composing poetry. Very, very powerful words where she says, صلى الإله على روح فضمنه قبر فأصبح فيه العدل مدفونا. May Allah shower His salawat and blessings on the soul, تضمنه قبر, when the grave took him in, فأصبح فيه العدل مدفونا. It was not Ali who was buried in there, it was Adl which was buried with him. Means when Ali went, justice is gone. This is what we get from people like you. And so Muawiyah says, what do you know about the justice of Ali? And she says, I'm actually remembering the day where I went to him with a similar complaint like I've come here today. And I went inside, he was doing his Nafila prayers. He sensed I was there, he shortened his prayers, turned to me and he said, you know, what is your hajat? Why have you come here? And when I presented the case of his revenue officer, who was being, you know, harsh than required in his dealing with the issue of, you know, taking revenue for the government, Amir al-Mu'mineen, according to her, he cried at that time on the musalla, raised his hands and says, Allahumma inni lam amur bi dhulmi khalqik. O Allah, you be witness. I did not ask my officers to be unjust to the people. If someone from my officer has done this, it's not because I have asked them to do this. And he immediately asked for the paper and pen, and he wrote a letter to this person instructing him to come back as soon as he gets the letter so that he can then, you know, present his own side of the story.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Around the world with reporters.
The situation in the Afghan capital Kabul is getting worse as a big chaos is ongoing in and around Kabul International Airport. Thousands of Afghans rushed to Kabul International Airport only a day after Taliban took control of the capital Kabul almost a week ago.
This is a tragedy for every single Afghan national. The U.S. claims that it has spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan. No, they were not after making good governance system in our country. They were only after imposing the current situation on our people and Afghanistan.
Chaos in Kabul airport has so far resulted in the death of at least 20 Afghans, including women and children. The horrifying situation in and around Kabul International Airport has created a big chaos.
People had heard something about the evacuation of Afghan nationals by the U.S. and other foreign troops from Kabul International Airport. So thousands of them gathered around the airport to get into it. But it was just a rumor because even many passport holders couldn't get into the airport.
This comes as the Taliban blamed the U.S. forces for failing to bring the situation under control in the airport, an issue that, according to the Taliban, has led to the loss of civilian lives. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
The hasty and chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has rattled the idea that the South Korea-U.S. alliance is as, quote, ironclad, as diplomats say. Analysts suggest that the presence of U.S. forces here in South Korea serves U.S. interests, both in terms of deterring North Korea and for checking the expansion of China's influence. But those U.S. interests didn't prevent former U.S. President Donald Trump from threatening to remove U.S. forces from South Korea. to force Seoul to pay more for hosting U.S. troops. South Korea's hosted tens of thousands of U.S. troops on dozens of bases throughout the country since the 1950 to 53 Korean War. As a U.S. ally, Seoul is expected to participate in U.S. missions abroad. Security policy analyst Lee Tae-ho argues South Korea's automatic participation in U.S. conflicts is unjustified.
The National Assembly's approval to dispatching troops to Afghanistan and Iraq indicates that South Korea participates in such wars to support American counterterrorism warfare. And unfortunately, the Korean government does not provide any official evaluation afterwards.
For South Korea, the U.S. failure in Afghanistan provides lessons to the South Korea-U.S. alliance and its strategy of entering and occupying North Korea, if and when Pyongyang is no longer in control.
Even though military forces from all over the world took part, it only showed that taking one country by force is not sustainable. For us, it implies that the current military plan between South Korea and U.S. of invading North Korea when it becomes unstable is in fact unrealistic.
He also suggests the South Korea case is different from Afghanistan, as this country has its own advanced military to deter North Korea, although more emphasis needs to be given to negotiations with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Pro-Palestine activists in England have caused major disruption once again for Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems in Oldham on Monday, after members of the Palestine Action Group occupied one of Elbit's buildings in an attempt to halt the firm's activities. Press TV arrived on location just hours after the stunt was launched.
This isn't the first time that this particular facility has been targeted by Palestine Action, and the group say that they will continue to target sites like this until there is a significant change for the Palestinian issue. Now, they have claimed that they have a long queue of future potential activists lining up to conduct this type of action, and that's because there are many, many people in the general public that feel as if they want to do more for Palestine, and they seem to have reached the conclusion that they have little alternative but to do radical action like what we see taking place behind me in order to force the issue.
As well as occupying the roof, some activists blocked the main road, while others smashed windows before smearing the building in red paint. The colour symbolises the blood of Palestinians killed in Gaza.
These people are saying, here's pots of red paint, we want to stop arms. At some point in time, the arms trade will be as vilified as the slave trade was a couple of hundred years ago, and that's what we intend to achieve through this. Here behind us, many people don't even know it's Elbit because it used to be called Ferranti. It doesn't have a big Elbit sign up. It should have a big sign saying Elbit, killer of Palestinian children. That's the sign it should have outside.
Due to the illegal nature of these protests, the activists will be arrested. Some already carted off as we arrived. The activists also risk fines, lengthy court battles, and possible jail time. Yet, they keep coming back.
No, Elbit is going to close this factory. I give you that as a promise. Elbit's profits are what we want to hit. Elbit as an organisation we want to hit. Elbit will go away because there is enough protest from the communities of this country outside of its factories to say, we do not want your bombs. We want to free Palestine.
Oldham's site is used to manufacture specialist military products, which have been used in successive Israeli attacks on Gaza. So, while Gaza remains besieged, Palestine Action vows to continue, as they put it, occupying the occupiers. Robert Carter, Oldham.
For the third day, Iran's parliament has been reviewing the qualifications of President Raisi's proposed ministers. Iran's struggle to contain the resurgent coronavirus pandemic took central stage in parliament, as the president's pick for Health Minister Bahram Einollahi was up for debate. As is the rule, one supporter and one opponent took the podium to speak for or against the nominee.
The coronavirus is killing at least 500 of our people every day. Not only is it taking people's lives, but it's overshadowing their businesses. The next health minister needs to be a powerful manager to steer our country out of the existing health crisis.
The health minister-to-be then had 30 minutes to defend his qualifications.
We must impose a serious lockdown in the country. If we shut down our cities for only 2 weeks, it will not help stem the tide of the pandemic. Instead of fining those who breach the lockdown, we must prevent travels and gatherings until the virus is totally gone.
Among the cabinet's hotshots was Hossein Amir Abdollahian as the proposed foreign minister, who, if approved, will lead Iran's team in the Vienna talks, aimed at reviving the ailing nuclear accord signed in 2015 between Tehran and the world powers. The nuclear negotiations faced a hiatus following the end of former President Rouhani's term and the election of Raisi as the new president. Now, as Europe is urging Iran to come back to the negotiating table, Amir Abdollahian apparently does not find talks with the West as the ultimate solution to the country's troubled economy.
Our foreign policy won't be restricted to a specific region. It won't tie foreign policy to the nuclear deal. As we try to remove the sanctions, we also make our best to neutralize the sanctions.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament on August 12th, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then held 270 private meetings with the 19 proposed ministers to review their credentials. The open floor vote of confidence sessions kicked off on Saturday and are planned to culminate on Tuesday. But some MPs believe the process has been slow and may take longer to conclude.
The results of the vote of confidence process will shape the future of the country in many ways, from Iran's foreign policy and the fate of the nuclear deal to the country's battle against the resurging coronavirus pandemic. That's why lawmakers say they're trying to be meticulous in reviewing the credentials of the nominees. So the process may take longer than planned. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
In an interview with the Al-Khanadiq website, the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation for peace, Mohammed Abdusalam, said the UK presence on Yemen's soil is not new, and Yemenis reject any form of foreign presence on their land, and it is the right to fight those who come to invade the country militarily.
Since the beginning of the war, Yemeni people have rejected the foreign presence in any form and cannot accept that. We have made great sacrifices for our freedom and independence and to clean our land from foreign forces. Today, the world is following what is happening in Al-Mara Governorate. People of Yemen cannot accept the Saudi British occupation of Al-Mara, and we have come to the conviction that armed struggle is necessary to expel foreign forces, whether in Al-Mara or elsewhere.
Regarding the developments in Marib, Abdusalam said the liberated areas from forces backed by the Saudi-led military coalition in the Western Governorate are equal to the size of two Persian Gulf states. The chief negotiator added that battles are still going on in Marib and other fronts. He said the recent initiative offered by Yemen's Ansarullah movement is the key to end the war that the coalition started against Yemen in 2015, but Saudis have no real intentions to move politically. However, he noted that the initiative is still in force.
The other party must accept the initiative presented by Ansarullah because it establishes a comprehensive political solution. The other party will regret it if they didn't respond to this initiative because it aims to stop the war completely and end the suffering of Yemenis. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are the ones who have took the power to decide, and we are ready to talk with the Yemeni parties if they have enough courage to take action by themselves.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has intensified its air raids on Marib in what experts describe as a desperate attempt to back the Saudi-backed forces on the ground as the Yemeni army keeps marking new advances toward the city of Marib.
Experts believe that Ansarullah has the upper hand as the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city of Marib. They say Ansarullah's initiative is a great opportunity for Riyadh to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen. The Abdullah Gloshali, Sana.
Seoul Metropolitan Government's Yongsan City Memorial Exhibition Hall is holding an exhibit, July 16th, Yongsan.
It shows footage for the first time in South Korea of the July 16, 1950 U.S. bombing of Yongsan, central Seoul's district, which killed hundreds of civilians.
U.S. B-29 bombers sent to destroy military targets like Yongsan Station switchyard also hit civilian buildings. 3 weeks before, on June 25th, the Korean War had broken out and North Korean forces had crossed the 38th parallel, capturing Seoul just 3 days later.
The footage obtained from the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration shows bombs being dropped and bodies strewn on the ground. Videos and photos edited from it are organized under four themes to highlight wartime suffering and healing after the 1953 armistice.
The bombing killed at least 1,587 of Yongsan's 193,000 residents, and 47 B-29 bombers dropped some 1,500 bombs, as this bomber was highly inaccurate and had to drop many bombs.
The event draws many curious visitors from Seoul and Greater Seoul's smaller cities and towns.
I'm glad the footage was released. Forgetting this incident would be a tragedy. We should not ignore or hide an unexpectedly large number of civilian deaths an aerial bombing unintentionally caused.
West of Seoul in Incheon, General Douglas MacArthur's statue overlooks the port where he led the famed September 1950 landing that led to the South recovering Seoul.
Some people criticize him because he did not take, at least this is what they say, enough care to minimize civilian casualties during the bombing of Yongsan Station in 1950.
In his latest speech on the anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japan's colonial rule at World War II's end, the same day Korea was divided, the South's president urged inter-Korean peace, the exhibit's underlying message.
East and West Germany achieved unification after 45 years. Division is the biggest obstacle to our growth and prosperity, a tenacious barrier to permanent peace. Like Germany, we can remove it.
The exhibit, which opened recently on the anniversary of the bombing and will run at least until this year's end, serves as a powerful reminder war must never happen on the Korean Peninsula again. Jennifer Chang, Seoul.
As part of a new plot to seize further Palestinian lands, the Jewish National Fund, a Zionist organization, has initially agreed to allocate $100 million to register the Palestinian lands in East Al-Quds and the West Bank in name of settlers. The new plan could lead to the eviction of further Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. According to Israeli Peace Now Group, the establishment is encouraging settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. The Peace Now noted that the right-wing regime of Israel is seeking to seize more Palestinian lands through the Jewish National Fund.
This regime will do anything in its power to first expand settlements and second to annex more Palestinian areas. And now, with the help of this gang establishment known as the Jewish National Fund, Bennett's regime is working to achieve his goal, that is to back illegal settlement construction.
The fund covers about 17,000 properties, most of them inhabited by Palestinians. Observers say this is the same scenario carried out earlier in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. Palestinian families are fighting legal battles to prove their ownership of the properties amid Israeli efforts to evacuate them forcefully from their homes.
The policy has been adopted many times in the past. Today, the Zionist organization is seeking to forge documents and displace more Palestinians both in West Bank and Al-Quds. They are after imposing their full control over the whole city.
The Jewish National Fund is a Zionist organization founded in 1901 to buy and develop land in Ottoman and Mandatory Palestine for Jewish settlers. Earlier this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warned that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, they warn, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban vow comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by their members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported, amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020. Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. We now present you an article written by Jeffrey Frankel, a professor of Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. The piece is titled, G20 must prioritize global COVID action at October meeting. Finance ministers, central bank governors, and political leaders are hard at work preparing for the 2021 G20 Heads of State and Government Summit in Rome, Italy, on 30th and 31st of October. With the COVID-19 pandemic stretching well into its second year, the meeting will come at a time of heightened uncertainty about public health and the global economy. And though the mechanisms of international cooperation have been weakened by the pandemic and remain bruised by Donald Trump's legacy, they are more important than ever. Cooperation need not refer to international coordination of national monetary or fiscal policies. For the most part, countries on their own can move those levers in whatever direction is best for them. Instead, the G20 should focus on financial stability, trade, and vaccination. This is in addition to other important areas, especially the existential issue of global climate change, which should and will receive a lot of attention. Over the course of 2020, most countries responded to the health crisis and economic recession with government spending. But emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, cannot finance deficits as easily as can Europe and the United States, with its exorbitant privilege conferred by the dollar's global dominance. Fortunately, many of these countries managed to meet the acute need for increased spending without having to pay sky-high interest rates. Owing to the aggressive monetary stimulus provided by the US Federal Reserve and other major central banks, the initial declines in emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, currencies, security prices and commodity prices in March of 2020 were reversed after the US Federal Reserve's easing. But now it is August of 2021, and every country must contend with a higher debt for GDP ratio. At some point, the US Federal Reserve will signal an end to monetary easing and a coming increase in interest rates. Whenever that happens, investors will pull out of risky assets and lose enthusiasm for the emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Suddenly, EMDE debtors could face potential financial crises like those that struck in the 1980s and 1990s, or on a lesser scale, like the 2013 taper tantrum, when the US Federal Reserve triggered EMDE capital flight by suggesting that it will soon start to wind down its asset purchases. Accepting that there may be a bubble component to today's high prices for risky assets, the financial situation appears particularly fragile. Some say that soaring markets reflect economic fundamentals. For example, high price-to-earnings ratios in the United States stock market are said to be justified by the promise of digitalization and other productivity-enhancing technological innovations. But I would point to the surge in some financial innovations that do not enhance productivity. Think of the 6,000 old cryptocurrencies that have been created, and the rise of many stocks, special purpose acquisition companies, and non-fungible tokens. In any case, the G20 can help to reduce the likelihood and severity of a potential emerging market debt crisis. The debt service suspension initiative that it created during the pandemic was a first step, but it only postponed repayment, and only for one class of international creditors, governments. It is widely recognized that provisions for possible debt restructuring should be extended to cases where the international creditors are private financial institutions, or where Chinese state-backed lenders are claiming to be private. A second step is the new allocation of special drawing rights agreed to by International Monetary Fund IMF members recently. Both initiatives come just in time for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Early on, it appeared that the impact of the pandemic would be more severe in advanced economies than in many EMDEs, with the exception of South America. But rich countries have since enjoyed unusually strong economic recoveries, aided by macroeconomic stimulus and the vaccines. Meanwhile, the other half has fallen behind. In its most recent global outlook for July of 2021, the International Monetary Fund predicted continued strong growth for advanced economies, but marked down its growth forecast for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Among developing countries, millions of people are being thrown back into extreme poverty. This economic divergence is particularly striking because it comes on the heels of a global convergence. On average, emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, had been growing substantially faster than advanced economies from the turn of the century until 2014, when Chinese growth started to slow and dollar prices for commodities fell. Among the many explanations for the catch-up period is that global trade increased roughly twice as fast as gross domestic product GDP during the decades preceding the 2008 global financial crisis. However, since 2009, the trend for the trade to GDP ratio has been flat. Unfashionable, as it is to say, the situation today calls for some old-fashioned trade liberalization. The United States and China should roll back the protectionist barriers that they raised over the last 4 years. One sector that is especially ripe for liberalization is trade in environmentally beneficial products, such as the equipment used to produce wind and solar power. G20 member states should work with the World Trade Organization, WTO, to establish new international rules guiding carbon border adjustment taxes so that they can be used but not abused. The G20 also should work with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, to follow through on the exciting recent progress towards the Global Framework for Corporate Taxation. Most importantly, the United States and other rich countries must allocate more of their massive spending packages to make COVID-19 vaccines available to low- and middle-income countries. It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. Ruchir Agarwal and Geeta Gopinath of the International Monetary Fund have proposed a plan of action to get more vaccines produced and distributed throughout the world. Even someone who is allergic to altruism should favor programs for vaccination in other parts of the world. So long as the coronavirus runs wild anywhere, it is a danger everywhere. The stakes of international interdependence are higher than ever.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it. And that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We know that in Islam, knowledge is very, very important. We know that there's a very strong emphasis on pursuing knowledge, seeking knowledge, gaining as much knowledge as we can, especially when the knowledge is beneficial, especially when the knowledge is going to give you proximity and closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Jibra'il was asked about the virtue, the status of al-alim, and he said, al-alimu al-wahid akramu ala Allah. One alim is more honored by God, min alfi shaheeds, more honored than 1,000 martyrs. Fa'inna iqtida'u al-ulama bil-anbiya, because the ulama follow, they emulate the anbiya, and وَإِقْتِدَاءُ الشُّهَدَاءِ بِالْعُلَمَاءِ, and the martyrs, they follow or pursue, they emulate the ulama, which is exactly why, you know, when you find that kind of عَالِمٌ رَبَّانِي, someone who reminds you of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, someone who reminds you of akhirah, someone who, where you look at, you feel empowered, you feel strong, you feel motivated, you feel spiritual, you feel religious. At least during that time that you are with them, you have that sense of strength when it comes to your religious conviction, which is exactly why al-nazaru ila wajhi al-alimi ibadah, as the hadith says from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. Another hadith also from the Holy Prophet, al-nazaru ila wajhi al-alim, looking at the face of a alim is an act of worship. Looking at the face of a alim, khayrun laka min itqi alfi raqaba, it's better for you than if you were to free, if you were to emancipate 1,000 slaves. This is the virtue of a alim. This is the virtue of a knowledgeable person. And of course, especially someone who visits ulama, there is a strong emphasis on ziyaratul ulama, mujalasatul ulama, attending their gatherings, visiting them. There needs to be that level of consistency and you need to have a program. Each of one of us needs to have a program of regularly, frequently visiting ulama for whatever occasion it may be, whether it be for salatul jama'ah, whether it be if they have majlis of dhikr, whether it be if they have majlis of ilm, they have a gathering of sharing of knowledge, of conveying any kind of lesson or something like that. مَنْ أَحَبَّ أَنْ يَنْظُرَ إِلَىٰ عُتَقَاءِ اللَّهِ مِنَ النَّارِ فَلْيَنْظُرْ إِلَىٰ الْمُتَعَلِّمِينَ. If you want to see those people who will be free and far away from entering a hellfire, then look at the muta'allimeen, look at those who are learning, look at those who are attending the majalis of ulama. And which is exactly why it says, man akrama aliman, the hadith says from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, if you respect a alim, if you show honor to a alim, if you revere a alim, faqad akramani, then you are respecting Rasulullah.
Ayatollah Javadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخواید کشاورزی کنی یه قدری گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. اینم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم داشت خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
When you dignify an alim, you are dignifying the Prophet. And when you are dignifying the Prophets, you are dignifying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when you dignify God, فَمَصِيرُهُ وَمَنْ أَكْرَمَ اللَّهِ فَمَصِيرُهُ إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ then your destination will be heaven. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, وَمِنْ حَقِّ الْعَالِمِ أَنْ لا تكثر عليه السؤال ولا تأخذ بثوبه وإذا دخلت عليه وعنده قوم فسلم عليهم جميعا. A lot of etiquette when it comes to ulama, you know, don't ask too many questions. Try to be the listener. Absorb what you can from the alim. No, السؤال مفتاح. Many ahadiths emphasize and encourage us to ask questions. Yes, but at the same time, you need to absorb what the alim says. Listen to what the alim says. The alim is going to, of course, have a lot more to say. From experience, you will be able to pick up on many things, you know, just by being a little bit patient. He will cover it, you know, in you not having to ask the question, he will cover it. And in most cases, this is exactly what will happen. And that's what it means by this particular hadith, where you need, there's that etiquette that you need to be there, which is exactly why the hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, إِذَا جَلَسْتَ إِلَىٰ عَالِمٍ when you are in the presence of a scholar, فَكُنْ عَلَىٰ أَن تَسْمَعْ أَحْرَصْ مِنْكَ عَلَىٰ أَن تَقُولْ then make sure you are there. You are more adamant to listen than you are to speak or ask. Listen, absorb, gain what it is that you are able to. Maybe what you might think what he is saying is not relevant to you or not applicable or something like that. But be patient and you will see if, of course, he is that kind of a person. وَتَعَلَّمْ حُسْنَ الْإِسْتِمَاعِ and learn how good it is, or the good way of being a listener, being a listener. You know, many of us, you know, we just want to question and we just want to ask, we just want to critique, we just want to object. You know, in these, you know, in these ahadith, we're listening, we're hearing another side of it. Even though that side is important in its own context, but this side is also very, very important as well. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart, there will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.